This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
In the weeks ahead, Lake County is going to be asking for public support and public comment on what is being called the County Comprehensive Master Plan. There is a plan in place. It's an old plan, and we'll find out more about all of this, and you'll learn more about what is expected to come in the creation and adoption of this plan and how the procedure is going here in Lake County. We have with us County Commissioner Jerry Tippy and County Surveyor Bill Emerson. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, whoever wants to start out, let's talk first about the little history lesson here as to what Lake County is going through now as far as planning. There is a plan in place out there, but it's a pretty old plan, I understand, as they typically go. And that's causing some problems, I would imagine, in helping determine the best use of the properties out here in Lake County.
That's right. That's right. I want to thank you for having us on today to kind of spread the word about what we're doing and how we're trying to bring our county comprehensive plan more up to date. But it's an entire rewrite of our plan. We've noticed over the kind of recent years that there's development that wants to happen and is coming to unincorporated Lake County, and sometimes the zoning ordinances we have in our plan don't quite jive with some of that development. And we're looking to update it and to do that. And I think and Commissioner Tippy has actually gone through this process in Schererville. He's been great to work with on. And so we want to make sure the public has a lot of input. And that's really the focus of what we're doing. We want to make sure that any changes we make to the comprehensive plan and eventually our zoning ordinances have a lot of public input.
Within the boundaries of Lake County, how much of the county property is in unincorporated parts of it? Because we have a lot of communities. We have probably more communities in this county than any other county in Indiana. And so that takes up a lot of space physically, sure. But there is space out there that isn't part of a town or a city.
That's right. And the exact number on that, I'm not quite sure, Commissioner.
I'm looking at a map over on my wall here, and it looks to be a little bit more than 50% of the actual land is unincorporated.
Now, is most of that in the south part of the county?
Yeah, I would say 90% of it is south of Route 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But still, just the same, that's still property, and even north of, we'll say north of U.S. 30, which people tend to kind of be the dividing line, that is still a lot of small pockets, or relatively small pockets of property out there, and I'm sure that probably not all of the proper or best uses of all that land has ever been determined within what you're working with now, Bill.
Well, that's exactly right, and there's a lot of unincorporated Cal Township property. There's some in Hobart Township as well. That it's all going to be part of this plan, and we ask anybody in those areas or around, and anyone in the county really who's interested in the future of development in Lake County to come out to the public meetings and to give us your input online as well. We will be having one of our public meetings in Cal Township as well. So.
Okay. Jerry, we set up the mechanism to get this new comprehensive land use plan for the unincorporated parts of Lake County started. You have a little timetable. You have a certain procedure that you also have to follow, too. What's that procedure?
Yeah, that's correct. We're going to hold four public meetings for input and to educate the residents. We're actually going to have a fifth meeting. Our second meeting is going to be held one in Lowell and one in Calumet Township, mm-hmm. So that we people have the ability to come to either one of those meetings. As we get to the third and fourth meetings, a draft plan will be presented to the community for comment, and then finally there will be approvals by the county council, county commissioners, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. How much work has been done up to this point, Bill, on getting things together so that you have at least a framework of what you, not only what you have as far as the plan's concerned, but what you hope that you can get people to talk about?
Sure. So honestly, a lot of the work up front was getting the RFP together to figure out what exactly we wanted, what we could afford with our budget as far as a consultant and to picking the correct consultant for the job. And I think we have done a great job with that. And now really we're kind of in the preliminary stages where we're looking at, kind of where we're at as a county, where we're going, where the development is happening and how best to kind of prepare for that and plan.
And Arch Group, I understand, is the consultant, and, yes. and they're very experienced in handling matters like this, I understand.
That's right. They are. They've done a few comprehensive plans and a lot of other work locally. They're a local team, so they have a good flavor of kind of what's going on locally, so it's a good thing.
Okay. From your standpoint, Bill, as the county surveyor, you get to work with people that have questions about property, property owners coming in wanting you to do certain things with their property, and they have to come in to consult with you and your staff to find out, first off, what they can do with the land based on what the plan is like. And then probably some people are probably a little frustrated about the way that things are set up, and they'd like to see some changes too, I would imagine.
That's true. That's right. And I think a lot of this is responding to some of those issues and those concerns that people have had about, you know, hey, you know, I want to do this, maybe this development, but there's nothing in your ordinance that allows me to do it, or it has to be done a different way. So we want to make sure that we're you know, open for business as Lake, you know, as Lake County for businesses that want to come in, and that we're being smart about how, you know, residential development happens as well.
If you can, and without naming names, if you wish, give us an example or two of where people have come in where they've wanted to have some changes made on property, and the current zoning, or certainly the current land use plan, doesn't suit their needs. It doesn't make them happy, for that matter.
Sure. So, one example in general, I guess speaking in generalities, because some of it isn't always public on the specifics, but you know, the area around Route 2 and 65, I think there are some companies that would like to develop and you know, bring local jobs in, and both for construction and ongoing jobs. And we want to make sure that, you know, before some of those decisions are made on those large-scale plans, that we are engaging with the public, and that we you know, take everybody's concerns into consideration.
Do you find also in some of the land corridors, say along US 41 in South Lake County, that's kind of the same situation, that you have developers that would like to do things out there? They have lots of wide open spaces south of Cedar Lake, and before you get down to Highway 2 to get to Lowell, that they'd like to do, but maybe that the land use isn't to their liking or what they can do with it?
Yes, that's part of the process. The Route 41 corridor will be analyzed for potential areas of targeted development. I don't know that the entire corridor is going to be prime for development in this plan, but specific areas such as the Route 2 intersection will definitely be looked at.
So you've got certain areas that are close to where people live and where other businesses are that you can want to take advantage of that as well, too, I suppose. We've talked about the need to be able to properly set forth land use, and you're working with a plan now that's 25 years old. How old do comprehensive land plans usually live their life before they have to be worked on like this?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think definitely 25 years is a good time to do a new one. I know that for sure. You know, anything short of that, I suppose, would be up to the individual community kind of to decide. But I'd also point out that, you know, I guess from my personal perspective, being on sitting on NERPC as well, you know, my preference overall as a region would be to kind of, you know, reinvest in our existing communities and do development where it most makes sense. But a lot of times, you know, there are companies and other entities want to do something in unincorporated areas, so that's a good thing too. But I think, you know, my first preference would be to, you know, keep the development, you know, and reinvest in where it is.
I suppose if you've got companies that want to put in a new industry or larger businesses, they need more space.
Sure.
They have to specifically look for property to work with. Mm-hmm. That's probably where I'm sure that need comes in handy. But I would imagine too, you have these smaller pockets, I suppose you could say, of land in the in the north half of the county, we'll say, that still up there exists, that there are probably some proper uses that should be given to that land.
Sure. And that's kind of generally the way I lean personally. But, again, that's why we're doing this comprehensive plan, is to take everyone's sort of, you know, input and make sure that we're listening to everyone.
Jerry, do you, as a county commissioner, get a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, and maybe some criticism as well with the way that the current comprehensive land plan is here in Lake County? And that kind of helps bring along the idea that we need to do a completely new plan to make things fresh.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the major components, and Bill touched on it, is to try to direct the development into the areas that fit with modern planning. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is encourage development around the existing cities and towns, and get the feel for those border towns. Yeah, they'll be included in the process so that we can start communication with them and hopefully encourage development in those areas.
Now, you mentioned there will be a series of public meetings to talk about what is up there now as far as the comprehensive land use plan is concerned in the unincorporated areas of Lake County. First public meeting is coming up very soon, I understand, and give us an idea of what kind of structure that meeting is going to have.
First meeting is going to be October 24th, 6 o'clock, right here in the Government Center. So it's going to be really, again, kind of just kind of explaining kind of where we're at as a county, where we'd like to go, explaining what the comprehensive plan is and what it does, and then really getting a lot of public input. That's really the goal, is to see, you know, as a county, where we want to go and how we plan for that. So that's kind of the goal. So we'd ask everybody, if you're available, to come out. If you're not, to go on the website. It's lakecountyplan.org is the website. To give your input, to learn about what we're doing, and to be involved.
And this is a new and specifically designed website so that people can get to it easily. They don't have to navigate any of the sites. They can put the address in, and they'll find out all the information that's up there now for the public to learn about what's done so far and how they can fit into the process, I suppose.
That's right. And we want to be as transparent as possible, put everything out there, and make sure that everybody feels included. And I'd also add to the discussion about the development, as we're going through it, we're also very cognizant and aware of the agricultural community in Lake County, especially in the unincorporated area, and the need that to maintain that as well. So it's a multi-pronged approach.
Well, you probably deal with that a lot more than most people do with your job as county surveyor, and as you say, you have to work up with people that have a lot of agriculturally zoned land or land that is certainly potential agricultural zone, and they're very concerned about how their land gets used, and that if you're talking family farms that have been around for decades or even 100 years plus, you want to be sure that they get treated as well as the company that wants to come in and take up land and turn it into a factory site or something like that.
That's exactly right, and a lot of the things we do, Commissioner Tippy, as a member of the Drainage Board as well, we deal with a lot of drainage issues throughout the county, all the way, from Cal Township up north, Gary, Cal Township, all the way down to the Kankakee River. So we have a good feel for a lot of that as well.
We should mention that, too. That is part of it, because you wouldn't think of it, but when you live south of U.S. 30 and you've got big expanses of land, and the drainage ditches are very, very important in that part of the county, just as, in fact, probably more so than in the north half of the county, I would imagine, Jerry.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, the higher volume of issues takes place in the south part of the county. But I wanted to mention, too, because I know when people hear the word plan, that they think that there's a 10-step plan to changing the face of Lake County. The word guideline is probably a better word than plan. So people who come out, keep in mind that we're establishing guidelines for future development. And also to keep in mind, we have what we call key elements. So the key elements, things that we'll be discussing, if you come out to the meeting, keep these things in mind. It's community character, land use, transportation, housing, growth management, parks and recreation, community facilities, economic development, and special districts. So there's a lot to cover.
Yeah.
So if you have any interest in any of those areas, any comments you'd like to make in those areas, please bring them to one of the meetings.
And once again, the very first public meeting is going to be on Tuesday evening, 6 o'clock, and it'll be held where we're sitting and talking now here at the Lake County Government Center.
In
the auditorium. A big room to hold a lot of people, because we're sure that a lot of people will want to come by and find out more about this, and especially that you mentioned, Jerry, about all the other facets of the process that people don't necessarily connect with it, such as recreation land and that sort of thing, too. It's all part and parcel, literally, of what the comprehensive land use includes, I suppose. We're talking with Lake County Commissioner Jerry Tippy and with Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson, who is the president of the Lake County Plan Commission. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. We appreciate your time to talk about this topic and as well to let us know what the public needs to know and to be sure that they show up for any of the public meetings. And we'll have more information, of course, on Regionally Speaking as well as in the newscast about when the public hearings are coming up so people will know when to be out in their particular neighborhood and speak out and find out more about the comprehensive land use plan. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
So the third fear I want to address is the one that I think is often the biggest, and that's this. These screens are isolating me from my child. So let's play out a scenario. Let's say that you are a parent and you need 25 minutes of uninterrupted time to get dinner ready. And in order to do that, you hand a tablet to your three-year-old. Now, this is a moment where you probably feel very guilty about what you just did. But now imagine this. 20 minutes later, you receive a text message on that cell phone that's always within arm's reach. And it says, Alex just matched 5 rhyming words. Ask him to play this game with you. Can you think of a word that rhymes with cat? Or how about ball? In our studies, when parents received simple tips like these, they felt empowered. They were so excited to play these games at the dinner table with their kids. And the kids loved it too. Not only did it feel like magic that their parents knew what they'd been playing, kids love to play games with their parents. Just the act of talking to kids about their media can be incredibly powerful.
The vice president of PBS Kids Digital came on recently on a TED Talk series and talked about a topic that I think is unusual and you might like to hear more about, especially if you have youngsters at home and you watch PBS Kids programs like the ones we offer on Lakeshore PBS, our sister station. Sarah DeWitt talked about 3 fears about screen time for kids and why they are not true. And we have Sarah DeWitt with us to talk about it. Sarah, thanks for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
What was the idea behind your TED Talk that you had recently?
Well, really, I work every day with kids and new technologies, helping develop digital content for kids. And I thought I was going to talk about cutting edge kind of new things that are happening, but I realized the overarching thing that I hear from parents is the fears they have about what screens are doing to their kids. So I really wanted to tackle that head on, that basically we have kind of a vague anxiety about kids and screens. And the truth is the screens are just a tool, the way that, you know, books are a tool or the way that art supplies can be a tool. And it's really about how we use them in kids' life that can bring about real power. So that's what I wanted to tackle, to really say, what's scaring us about these and how can we find actually the positives? How can we make these positive moments in a kid's life?
Do you think that the idea kind of came from the fact that screens are the 21st century and high-tech version of paper?
Well, I think so. I mean, if you go way back, people used to be very afraid of novels, right? Mm-hmm. And thinking that these were going to ruin young women's minds in particular. Yes, but I also think that it's not just the 21st century. In the 20th century, there was a lot of concern about television.
Yeah.
And I personally believe that Fred Rogers, who did Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, did a lot to really show the U.S. that screens could be used as a force for good, as something really positive. They could help children begin to recognize their own feelings. It could encourage talking about when you're mad and talking about when you're confused. And I think that really changed the way that a lot of people looked at television, particularly for television for young children. And I think, you know, interactive technologies, new digital technologies, are at that same point. We're at a moment where we can really look at it to find the positive potential for kids. It doesn't have to be something that's just kind of sucking away our time. It can be something that actually gives kids some good content and some good ideas.
Do you think it was on a much more personal level compared, compared to what the Sesame Street was offering about the same time?
I guess Sesame Street also is another great example of a show that really kind of rethought how kids could learn through television.
Mm-hmm.
When you came up with the idea for the TED Talk, give us an idea of some of the things that you brought up during your conversation. And by the way, too, you can always check out this TED Talk, too, on their website if you want to see the whole thing in its entirety. But give us a little snippet of what you brought up, and you've kind of brought up some things already, but one in particular that seemed to get the attention of the audience you were talking to.
Well, one is the idea that parents are so afraid of screens making kids too sedentary, you know, connections to the obesity crisis and things like that. And one of the things I pointed out is with the advent of cameras on our screens, we actually have an opportunity to get kids up and moving while they play. So I shared an example from the Wildcrats website, a game called Going Batty, where we brought kids in for testing, and their job was to stand in front of the camera and basically mimic bat motions. And one of the things I thought was so amazing was when we turned off the game, when we finished testing, the kids kept being bats. They kept flying around the room, and they kept talking about the things they'd learned about bats. So using the technology to kind of get kids moving. Another thing that I tackled was the idea that playing games is just a waste of time, that this is really just downtime for kids and you know, kind of turning their brains to mush. And sharing some of the research that's been coming out about what you can see about a kid's learning through gameplay. So the example I shared there were games developed by WGBH in Boston with Curious George, and how they were focused on early math skills. And not only can you see that kids are learning the math through playing these games just for a really short period of time, like 20 minutes, we also realized that when you got really deep into the data, the gameplay data could make a good prediction of a child's standardized test score in math. So this raises, for me, all kinds of future implications. You know, you hear so much about testing anxiety and kids being kind of over-tested. What if playing a game could actually give the teachers the insight they need into where a child is in their learning and what they need in terms of individualized attention in the classroom? Real potential there.
I know that we do focus on with the PBS Kids programs, in particular to the younger people in pre-learning situations. Do you think that there are some examples that you're finding now with the programs, with the youngsters that are grown up with PBS Kids programs, that this way when they get into the traditional school setting, that helps them learn better?
We hear that kind of anecdotal, all those anecdotal comments from parents all the time, that they see that their kids have picked up good learning habits from what they've watched on PBS Kids that's helping them once they get to kindergarten or helping with the vocabulary. I don't know of any longitudinal studies yet that have proven this, but we certainly hear it from parents a lot.
Well, I'm sure that it does. It's word of mouth. I'm sure a lot of it, the parents talk with teachers and with other educators in school when the youngsters come into the learning setting outside of their home, and they say, hey, well, my youngster learned about this because she likes PBS Kids, and she maybe mentioned some specific programs in particular.
I can give you that example of my own kindergartner. Last week, his teacher asked each kid to name a word that started with V and to draw a picture. And he chose the word venomous because he had just watched a Wildcrats episode about snakes. That actually came home in his folder. The teacher couldn't believe that he was talking about the word venomous. Of course, he didn't know how to spell it, but...
Well, that's all right. That comes later, you know. Just the idea that your youngster knows what venomous means in the respect of how you use it in the sentence, and it's very important, too. Well, Sarah, what do you think are going to be some of the next things that PBS Kids Digital will be able to bring forth, not only to the screen so that youngsters that watch PBS Kids programs on Lakeshore Public PBS, on Lakeshore PBS, will have a chance to take advantage of. But what do you think that we'll get to see nationally now? Any ideas?
Well, definitely we're going to be doing a lot more with engaging parents in what kids are watching. So we're spending a lot of time thinking about how we deliver tips and tools to parents to help them know how to talk about what kids are watching so that they can get the most out of what they're learning from television and the most out of the games. And also lots of hands-on activities, because of course we love it when kids interact with media but then take it to the real world, like actually go dig in the dirt and start to to look for some of those things they learned about on Nature Cat, see if they can find it in real life.
In addition to that, you also get youngsters out in the fresh air and get them away from the screen to see the real world out there.
Exactly. The hope is that they see something on PBS Kids that really sparks their curiosity and their passion. You know, they see the kids on Dinosaur Train, little dinosaurs on Dinosaur Train, making collections of things they find in nature. Now, will they take that outside and start looking for acorns on the ground or interesting leaves and start their own nature collection, hoping that they'll model some of the behaviors we have on TV?
Sarah DeWitt is the vice president of PBS Kids Digital. She's been with us to talk about the topic of youngsters who maybe their parents thought might be a little afraid of them spending so much time in front of the television or the screen in general, I suppose, and why these fears are not true. And she had a chance to talk on a TED Talk recently about that. Sarah, thank you very much for sharing time with us, and we hope that we get to see some of these great improvements come in future shows on PBS Kids.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm not here to suggest to you that all digital media is great for kids. There are legitimate reasons for us to be concerned about the current state of children's content on these screens. And it's right for us to be thinking about balance. Where do screens fit against all the other things that a child needs to do to learn and to grow? But when we fixate on our fears about it, we forget a really major point, and that is that kids are living in the same world we live in, the world where the grown-ups check their phones more than 50 times a day. Screens are a part of children's lives. And if we pretend that they aren't, or if we get overwhelmed by our fear, kids are never going to learn how and why to use them. What if we start raising our expectations for this media? What if we start talking to kids regularly about the content on these screens? What if we start looking for the positive impacts that this technology can have in our children's lives? That's when the potential of these tools can become a reality. Thank you.
That's Sarah DeWitt from her TED Talk. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana's ports move millions of tons of the stuff that's made and used at Midwest factories, stuff like steel, grains, and coal. The ports connect Indiana to the fast-changing national and global economies. Today, in the first of a three-part series, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek tells us how the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor has secured its place in the steel industry.
When you picture a port, you might picture water and a dock with a big container ship tied up. Burns Harbor is not that port, but it's the closest thing to it in Indiana, amid steel mills and sand dunes on the shores of Lake Michigan.
My name's Ian Hurt. I'm the port director at the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor.
And where are we right now?
We are in Portage, Indiana, on a lovely day. About to take a tour of the port.
At the water's edge, a loader is scooping some dusty white cargo out of a floating barge. It's a tiny bit of the 8 million tons of stuff this port moves every year. That's the weight of 36 Sears Towers. We can see Chicago's skyscrapers in the distance. Hurt says the minerals in this barge started out on a big ship.
Came across the Pacific, most likely through the Panama Canal, up to New Orleans.
That part can take 25 days.
Got loaded into barges in New Orleans. Those came up the Mississippi River, eventually to the Illinois River.
Through waterways around Chicago.
Out across Lake Michigan, and then into Burns Harbor.
That leg took 3 weeks. Now a truck can take this cargo from China to a warehouse in Ohio. All that wending over water is still the cheapest way per mile to move this stuff long distance. A barge can hold more than twice as much as a rail car and 75 times as much as a truck. Put another way,
it costs as much to bring a steel coil from Antwerp, Belgium to Burns Harbor by ship as it does bring a steel coil from South Bend, Indiana to Burns Harbor by truck.
Steel is a big reason this port exists. Burns Harbor is neighbors with the largest steel mills in the country, and their customers cluster up here to save money buying and moving the raw steel. Minnesota-based Ratner Steel is one of those customers. Its Burns Harbor plant manager, Ryan Molstead, says it can buy steel on port and truck it over or barge it in.
It's all about freight. Just the closer you are to it, the cheaper it is to get it from point A to point B, whether receiving it or shipping it.
The steel business isn't always stable. Global competition and technology have shrunk American mills in recent decades. Molstead says his U.S. suppliers know the port gives Ratner more places to get its raw materials, which keeps prices fair. Another plus for Burns Harbor, access to interstate highways for trucking products out.
So the port is right on the bottom of Lake Michigan, so we can go east. Minnesota, we couldn't go east effectively. As we moved here, we gained a lot of business out in Michigan, Ohio, and we keep going.
Back outside, longshoremen are relieving a big red ship of its cargo, steel beams from Germany. The vessel hails from the Marshall Islands, and Hurt, the port director, says it'll probably go north on the lakes to pick up grain bound for Europe when it's done here.
Basically, as soon as that last of that cargo comes off, they're going to throw off the lines and they're going to hit the marine highway.
The tugboat Arizona is waiting to turn the huge ship around, but right now her captain is asleep on the deck. This pace is typical at Burns Harbor, but soon officials hope their new resident stevedore, Metro Ports, will bring in more bulk cargoes like those minerals earlier. Steel is still the staple here and throughout Indiana's port system, but in such a volatile industry, it never hurts to diversify. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Portage.
And Annie will offer us more features on the ports of Indiana in the future here on Regionally Speaking. Indiana University Northwest wants to make sure that students understand the importance of recognizing and preventing sexual misconduct, as well as domestic and date violence and abuse, internal concerns about sexual harassment and stalking as well. Dean of Students Beth Tyler came on Regionally Speaking to talk about a number of programs on campus. She started out by talking about how unique the Gary campus is compared to IU Bloomington with its residence halls.
Essentially, when we're looking at prevention and awareness around sexual misconduct and sexual violence, we want to look at what are the particular challenges that our students face and what are our goals in doing programs around these kinds of issues for our students. And at a residential campus, any residential campus, a lot of what they're looking at is how to reduce instances of sexual misconduct on campus, right? That tends to be the number that they're looking at. They're also looking at general awareness around the issue. But when you're at a commuter campus where students do not live here, a lot of the experiences that they're having around sexual misconduct are happening in their lives and not here on campus. So the challenge for us is, what kind of outcomes are we looking for with our students to make sure that we are doing whatever we can to help them avoid situations in their lives and in the community that might cause them to confront any kind of sexual misconduct? How can we increase their awareness about what they can do to help themselves and others avoid issues, but also to understand that we, as an educational institution and as their home campus, want to be able to help them address any issues that they have and help ameliorate any problems that persist in their lives, and especially those that might affect their education as a result of any kind of bad experiences they've had, either prior to coming here mm-hmm. or after coming here.
I know that even during this month of October, there have been a number of programs that have been already initiated by the Office of Student Activities, taking the lead on many of these and helping in educating and making people aware of the problems of students being involved with dating violence, as well as with other types of domestic violence they may encounter in their lives. Tell us about how some of these programs, these discussions have happened so far to kind of enlighten people if they're not aware of it.
Well, we have something called Sex Signals on Campus, which is an interactive performance between two people on stage. And what they do is sort of enact various relationship scenarios and invite the audience to kind of comment on what they see occurring on stage, right? And so if there's a man and a woman interacting on stage and maybe they don't know each other, and the performers play out scenarios and invite the audience to kind of hold up a sign is what they did to say stop. When they saw the behavior of one of the other people getting to a place that was bordering on inappropriate or even illegal, right? So because sexual harassment is basically unwanted contact, and it's very important to understand the cues so that the person who might be about to perpetrate bad behavior kind of is aware, but also that the person who is perhaps being the recipient of unwanted contact knows enough to say that that's not appropriate and that they don't want it. So in many ways, what we're trying to get students to do is be more confident and comfortable speaking out about their own needs and desires and what their boundaries are. We had a panel of people whose work in the community is involved in responding to any kind of sexual, mostly sexual assault and sexual violence, and how we and what the process is that happens when a student reports an incident of sexual assault, perhaps. We had a SANE nurse, which is a sexual assault nurse examiner, a prosecutor, a rape crisis counselor, somebody who represents minorities and LGBT people, and a detective, because one of the biggest problems with reducing sexual assault and sexual violence in our communities is that people who are victims or survivors don't come forward. And mm-hmm. some of the reasons that they don't come forward is because they don't have faith in the process or they don't understand what's going to happen. If we can increase the confidence of people who might report an incident, we are more likely to have some sort of an accountability on the part of any perpetrator. And then we also had a speaker, Byron Hurt, who is a national figure. He's actually, I think, worked internationally. He's an anti-sexist activist and a filmmaker, and he did a talk called Locker Room Talk or Toxic Masculinity, and he was looking at the ways in which men and boys are socialized that might contribute toward male violence against women, and to sort of increase awareness among our students and faculty and staff who are in the audience about the ways in which we can prevent that by being engaged bystanders and trying to affect the way we perceive one another's behavior.
Dean Totter, I know last year the students got a chance to participate in what is called the Community Activities and Experiences with Sexual Assault Survey. It's a very long survey, and I know there are a lot of different parts and pieces to that, but if you will, give us a highlight of some of the things that you've probably no doubt gone through and looking at the results of it and what you've learned and what you think that IU Northwest officials can do to help students deal with some of these problems.
Sure. We abbreviate that, Chris. We call it the Campus Climate Survey, and it's mm-hmm. something that was done at every IU campus over the past year or so. And the goal was really to try to get a sense of what kinds of issues our students are facing, both before they came to IU Northwest and since they have come here. And what we have found, and what we already kind of knew from basically reporting on campus, is that the students tend to be experiencing much more off campus than on. And the particular challenges that we face that we think that we can assist with are, first of all, increasing students' awareness about the policies and procedures that we have on campus to help them if they do have an incident off campus. Even if it didn't happen on campus, we can often help them think about what their options are or to make sure that whatever experience they have doesn't have a negative influence on their academic work. So we're very interested in increasing awareness around what we can do to help them. We also learned that our students tend to have more experiences with sexual harassment in their lives, and I think it's often student-on-student sexual harassment, and again, that comes to the question of being comfortable saying what is and is not something, a behavior that you want someone to kind of, how you want to be interacted with in the world, and then to make clear to others that you don't want that, and that our students often are having issues at home with domestic and dating violence, right? So we want to do more programming around healthy relationships, informing our students about what sexual harassment is, what they can do to lessen it in their lives, and what we can do and what we want to do to help them if it happens.
That's Indiana University Northwest Dean of Students Beth Tyler. Well, her conversation here on Regionally Speaking, talking about programs to make students aware of sexual misconduct issues. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Northwest Indiana Food Council is working up its 2018 schedule of events after what Executive Director Ann Massey says was a very successful Farm Hop 2017.
Had just over 100 people come out that day for the four tours around Northwest Indiana. And so far, the feedback has been great. We're going through all of our surveys, and it looks like 100% of people said they would do it again. So we plan on doing it next year with a little change-up of separating out the tours so farmers and guests can actually go on more than one tour next year.
That's great. That's great. I know that I'm sure with such a wide variety of farms that were available to be looked at out there, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that wanted to do a nice mix of urban as well as rural or semi-rural farms. This way you give them an opportunity to really enjoy themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. We were pleasantly surprised to hear that there was that much interest. And
we're talking with Ann Massey, who is the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council, about some of the events coming up here that involve food and urban farming and the farmers that come here in Northwest Indiana to put together the great food that you can pick up not only at their own places but also available elsewhere too. One of the events coming up too we should talk about very soon in November is a Farm to Table Festival. Tell us about that. That's going to be held, by the way, at the Country Line Orchards in Lake and Porter Counties.
Yes, this will be the seventh year that the Farm to Table Festival has been going on. It started as a way to showcase and celebrate all the food created in our region, especially those created by urban farms and grown by urban farms in the Gary, East Chicago, Portage regions. It's usually about $40 for a ticket. It's family friendly. It's pretty much all you can eat, all you can drink. There's going to be beer tastings from about a dozen local breweries. There will be upwards of 6 to 8 different restaurants and chefs represented. And the team that puts this together works really hard to source every ingredient as locally as possible, down to the seasonings, the butters, the oils, all of that.
Do you think that some of the participants in the upcoming Farm to Table Festival might be some of the farms and other organizations that were involved in the Farm Hop this year?
Definitely. We are working with some of the farms that were on a couple of the tours who will be supplying ingredients for different dishes that evening. And pretty much, usually the farmers come too to enjoy the evening and eat good food and drink delicious beer.
That's right. Now that's coming up on November 4th, by the way. If anybody is interested in getting the tickets, how can they do that?
You can find them on County Line Orchard's website. They also should be available through their Facebook.
All right. Also, the Northwest Indiana Food Council has their final big meeting of the year coming up later in November, in fact, November 29th, and that's going to be happening in La Porte. Tell us more about that, if you will, Ann, and what you hope that that people will take advantage of if they come over to La Porte for the meeting.
Sure. We've had our series of meetups throughout the year. It's just a way for people to get together, connect about their local food projects. Some people who don't have projects going on who just want to know what's happening around the region. This is a casual way to meet over food or a beer if we happen to be at a brewery and talk in a relaxed environment. The PAC Center is a really interesting and important place in our region. It's a community kitchen that serves the La Porte area. And I encourage anyone who's interested in a volunteering opportunity to come out that night just to see what the PAC Center is all about. But we will also be there enjoying the meal that evening and getting to talk with people about local food projects in our region.
Now, I know we've talked here about the events bringing us up here towards the end of the year, but I'm sure you and other folks there with the Northwest Indiana Food Council have been looking ahead to 2018. Any ideas about what, besides the things like Farm Hop, are going to be on the schedule for 2018 as yet?
Yes, we will be doing the Farm Hop again, just revamping it a little bit so that people can go on multiple tours and you don't have to choose. Mm-hmm. And we will also have our food expo and discussion, we call FED, in early March or late February. And we'll have that date out here in the next week or two.
A famous and very popular Gilbert and Sullivan operetta is the theme of the next performance of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. The Mikado comes to the stage at the Bethel Church in Crown Point this coming Friday, October 27th. And the symphony's musical director and conductor, Kirk Muspratt, is with us to talk about it.
This is a hilarious piece. It's written in Victorian times about really the British aristocracy and the House of Lords and, you know, the Queen and all that and the King and things, and just how ridiculous British government was, all in the disguise of Japanese culture. So mm-hmm. The Mikado is the most inept person you'd ever meet. Nanki Poo is his son who's escaped, you know, his father and now travels as an itinerant second trombone player. Coco was a poor tailor who was put in jail for nothing. He was released from jail and just made the Lord High Executioner. And he doesn't have any idea what he's doing.
Well, not only that, but he can't do anything because if he's been charged to have to execute himself, you know, and he's not going to do that either.
Yes, and that's true. So anybody who flirts before they're 40 has to have their head chopped off. including himself. So it's just ridiculous. So we have some wonderful singers. Several of them just graduated from the Lyric Ryan program. We'll have some costumes, some wigs, some funny, you know, have a big sword, of course, to execute people. And it's a concert version, but it's really fun. And we'll have super titles so that you can understand all the amazing lyrics of Gilbert.
We haven't seen or heard very much of the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas here in Northwest Indiana for a while. Do you think that this will be a good chance to kind of introduce the crowd, so to speak, to these great pieces and might open the door to bring some more back later?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I haven't thought about this. It was just sort of an idea because it works. You know, we have the huge chorus, and I did this piece in Chicago last year with this cast. And when I spoke to the management about it, they thought it would be really fun. And they all really like Gilbert and Sullivan. Everybody loves Gilbert and Sullivan.
Because oh, sure.
It's the precursor of, you know, Broadway, really, and musical comedy. It's just, you know, 10 years, it's while vaudeville is getting started, and it's hilarious.
Well, we know there's so many people like the operettas, the gondoliers, and they also like ones like, even ones that are a little more unknown, like Iolanthe. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the Pirates of Penzance, we can't forget either. That's gotten a lot of people involved in learning about Gilbert Sullivan that way, too. So.
Exactly. It's a ton of fun.
Now, tell us about the tickets and how the Bethel Church is going to be set up for this great event coming up.
It'll be set up like a concert. So, you know, there'll be the chorus in the back, the orchestra. I'll be probably way out, and then the singers will come and go. And, you know, they have a little room to act, but there will be some acting, you know, there, and we'll have some fun, and it'll be it will be very, very funny. And the music is light and easy to absorb, and you go home whistling it.
I have to ask, who is going to take on the part of Pooh-Bah?
Ah, Pooh-Bah is David Govertson, because he is the grand everything of the everything of the everything. And he just graduated from the Lyric Ryan Opera program.
That's great. So it's going to be a great program coming up October 27th. Get a chance to hear some great music from Gilbert and Sullivan and a little acting on stage of Bethel Church of Mikado. Thank you very much, Kirk, for telling us all about it, and looking forward to it. Get your tickets now at the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra website and get set up for a great evening just before Halloween of the Mikado.
And with another edition of Eye on the Arts today, here is John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Philip Bauman, music director and conductor of the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you for having me, John.
Well, it's been a little while.
Sure has.
Yeah.
Sometime last spring, I believe.
Since we've been okay. Here, yeah. Well, I hope you've been flourishing.
Things have been going very well. We're very excited with the LaPorte Symphony to get our season kicked off with our public concerts in October. And something kind of new for us.
And this is going to be a Halloween concert?
Yes, we've never done a concert like this. Years ago, we had a family series of performances. And this our whole season this year is very much oriented to the family. And necessity is sometimes the mother of invention. And so for years, I've been trying to get a Halloween-ish concert into the books. And we looked at the calendar, and there were just too many things going on in November. And I said, well, here's a great opportunity for us to take advantage of. And so we're going to do a fun concert for the whole community and kids and adults alike.
So how many concerts do you do in your regular season?
We do three public concerts, and then we do our children's concert in October. Mm-hmm. And it is open to the public, but for our sake of subscribers, it's the children's plus the three that we do throughout the season.
And so these three concerts are a kind of an amalgamation of classical and what we call pops music.
Yes. Our November concert typically was what we call a pops classique, so kind of light classical works, maybe a heavy hitter in there somewhere along the lines, and some popular pieces. So this concert now, as a Halloween family concert, is really kind of the same mixture. We're going to be doing things from the movies, from the literature of classical music, things from The Witch's Ride from Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. Mm-hmm. We're doing some music from Faust and Night on Bald Mountain, but plus things from, you know, Beetlejuice, Batman, Spider-Man, the
fun
whole nine
stuff.
Yards. Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe that's a good way to approach
well,
concerts.
Yeah, and we've packaged this one. We're starting early, 7 o'clock. The concert takes place on October 28th. At 7 o'clock at the Civic Auditorium.
Yes.
And we're going to have the first half very much young children-oriented, so the things that they would be most interested in will take place there. And then we turn a little more adult, a little more mature in the second half of the program with some of the pieces like Edward Scissorhands and Dark Shadows and things that you know, aren't going to frighten anyone, but it's a little more spooky, shall
spooky,
we say.
Yeah,
yeah.
Scary.
So if, you know, if the kids need to go home, they can go home. We'll have a costume parade, and we're going to be just encouraging the community to celebrate this season. And we're hooking in also with the Mexican community in our area. There's a celebration in the Mexican culture, which is the Day of the Dead, or the right. Dia los Muertos, and they honor and celebrate the people who have gone before. And so we're asking the children to do a coloring page that would celebrate that. We're going to be put some pictures up on the screen while we play a specific piece to commemorate that. So, you know, trying to get into various cultures in our community and make this very much a family-friendly activity.
And are you and the musicians going to be in costume?
Absolutely. I can't tell you what my costume or costumes might be. It's top secret, but it will have something to do with some of the pieces we're playing in our program. So
top should be secret. I love that. Well, the intrigue and LaPorte.
Exactly.
It just ripples.
And another cool thing that we're doing, I'd just like to mention briefly, is that we are doing a piece by John Lithgow, the words by John Lithgow, music by Bill Elliott, called The Remarkable Farkle McBride. We're doing this as part of our children's concert. Yeah. And we're bringing it also to this concert. So the idea would be that a couple weeks earlier, the kids come to this concert and get excited, and they tell their parents, "Hey, let's go hear this piece again."
That's a great
piece. 15 minutes long, and it shows you the families of the orchestra.
Yeah, I love that.
And it should be a great way to introduce maybe new concert goers to the orchestra, as well as just having a good time.
And he just won, and John Lithgow just won an Emmy.
Yes.
For his portrayal.
That must be
of...
why he wouldn't come and do this for us. We asked him to come and narrate, but somehow the fee and the schedule didn't quite work.
And what is? Tell me about FACE.
Well, this is an initiative by our executive director to get involved with community engagement in our area. So we're creating what we call a foundation around community engagement, and we're asking corporations and individuals can do this too. Buy season tickets, donate them to one of the causes that we're supporting. So either getting disadvantaged children or adults or senior citizens, then they can hand off their tickets to these entities and come to our concerts free of charge. So we're looking for ways to be engaged in the community in that way.
That's excellent. Very proactive.
That's what we're trying to do. I mean, engagement's all the rage now, and it's very important. So.
And also while also interesting other people, new people in your music.
Right.
Well, great, Phil. Thank you for being here to tell us about the Halloween concert, especially, and FACE, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
This is John Kane of Eye on the Arts talking with Phil Bauman, who is the music director and conductor of the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, about the start of the season, Tales of the Dark Side. You can hear this conversation and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, if you missed this one. Tune in again next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.